This recording is brought to you by Whitworth University. To hear additional programs, please visit www.whitworth.edu/podcast.
Good morning again, everyone. You've almost made it. Congratulations. It's been a great week. I am so grateful to Terry and his staff and Whitworth for just a remarkable week. Thank you, President, for your hospitality. I think the Whitworth Institute of Ministry is a beautiful example of the church being served and resourced by a Christian university. It's a great model. And obviously others think so too. Is it 38th year? Yeah, what a great tradition. I am very jealous and grateful to be here. Thanks for your attention. Thanks for caring for my kids. I come from Pentecostal background, so I believe in miracles still. And here's the miracle I saw this week. A 15-year-old and a 17-year-old woke up every morning at 7:30 on their vacation without being told to go work. I'm hoping some of this comes home. I have no illusions in that regard. That's right. A couple of things, just as this is my last chance to, I have so much to tell you, but can't say enough. So I do want to build a little bit of bridge from yesterday. Two themes. One is Corey Widmer's question yesterday was very, very important because it gets at this theme. I'm obviously making the case for the importance and centrality of intentional Christian worship as the center of discipleship. What I don't want you to take away from this is any sense that that is the whole of discipleship or that that is adequate in and of itself. It's just that I think oftentimes North American Christianity has pursued all kinds of a penumbra of other discipleship practices and approaches without that center, without being able to count on that center. And I imagine the gathered center of the people of God rehearsing the story of the gospel in liturgical action is exactly the center we need to keep us anchored in that story and in that identity. And then that becomes the wellspring out of which our other practices together as the people of God draw their life. I will say this vision is really staked on a pretty strong sacramental conviction that when we gather together in worship, we are met by the triune God who lives and moves and is active in our worship and in the sacraments and in the Word. And in the way John Calvin sometimes seems to even talk about the Word itself as a kind of sacrament. And so that piece of the picture is I'm just trying to rebuild the center so that then we have an anchor for all of the other important things that we do together as Christians. Secondly, and this came up in conversations I often had after talks, you'll notice that this project kind of, very eloquent. Let me try that again. There's two sort of sets of challenges. Sometimes it's a matter of how do you take a congregation who has not absorbed and inhabited this historic mode of intentional worship? How do you take them from, forgive me for lack of a better word, sort of generic megachurch worship to historic intentional liturgical forms? That's one challenge. The other challenge is how do you get people who have been in the forms forever, but don't seem to understand what's at stake in them? How do you get that congregation to sort of re-own the practices, to see what's at stake in them? And this is where I think the energy of Christian education in many ways should be about liturgical catechesis. That is, it would be, I think, revolutionary if we thought of Christian education as having the goal of helping the people of God understand why we do what we do when we worship. Why do we do what we do when we worship? And then you'll people will sort of enter the sanctuary and enter that communal space together with a new sense of, well, what's at stake? Now, I actually think strategically and pedagogically, the way to get them to feel that significance is to actually help them to see the power of secular liturgies. In other words, the claim, because if I make these kind of claims that, you know, these little practices are actually shaping your imagination, or these rituals are doing something to you, they're not just something that you do, they do something to you. And if all people are thinking about the whole time is actually churchy stuff, they will remain quite skeptical. But if you start pointing out to them that in fact other cultural practices and rituals are shaping them without them realizing it, now it actually opens them up to realize, oh man, you're right, there's something going on in those practices that I don't articulate. Maybe there's something similar that's going on in gathered Christian worship practices that does the same. Does that make sense? So sometimes the strategy for coming to a new appreciation of the Spirit's work in Christian worship is to actually look at secular liturgies. And then you sort of flip the script and invite them back to that. In our last session together this morning, I actually want to, in a way, zoom in to help us appreciate how and why little things matter. That is, I want us to, in some ways, the subtitle of Imagining the Kingdom is How Worship Works. And a lot of what interests me is just how and why do seemingly little insignificant practices and rituals actually end up sort of implanting significance in our lives. And one of the sort of breakthrough insights for me was to recognize that in many ways, Christian worship works aesthetically. Now, I want you to hear that carefully. It works. Liturgy works on us the way literature works on us. Liturgy affects us the way poetry and song affects us. There's always something more going on than what we are aware of. And to be attuned to the aesthetic aspect of worship is not, hear me clearly, is not about making worship pretty. And it's not just about even beauty. It's just recognizing that there are ways that you get the gospel that are more than intellectual deposits. You pick them up through your senses. It's funny, for some reason, in our opening worship this morning, I was thinking of a scene I heard about when I was visiting a church in Langley, British Columbia. And it was a church that works in a pretty tough neighborhood. And on the one hand, you've got this sort of Dutch tribe, but they are actually breaking out of that and really trying to be a parish church that reaches their neighborhood. And you can see now, around, they have a common meal together. Talk about liturgies. Every Wednesday is a common meal where they just throw open the church for the whole neighborhood to come in. They have no idea who's coming, who's not, but the congregation is there and the neighborhood is there and they eat together. Echoes of Eucharist every Wednesday, okay? But, and so there, it's starting to have this really faithful presence in their neighborhood. And a single mom who has come from a really, really difficult, hard life, just a story that's heartbreaking to hear, came to Jesus Christ through the witness of this congregation. And she has two young boys, and they were all baptized together. And here was the coolest picture. This is a woman who has been left by every man who's ever been in her life. When she was baptized, she wore a wedding dress that she never got to wear. Now, she was worried that some of these kind of, you know, old-timers who think there's prim and proper things that you shouldn't do this, but the congregation ate it up. Why? Because it's a picture. It's a picture. She finally found the groom who would never leave her or forsake her. And I'm telling you, well, no matter what the pastor said about baptism that day or about conversion that day, it did not implant the story of picture in them the same way that just seeing her in the wedding dress being baptized would have done. See, there are these tangible, visceral, aesthetic, yesterday we said kinesthetic aspects of worship that picture the gospel for us, that make us able to touch and taste and see and hear and smell the story of God in Christ reconciling the world to himself. We need to take that seriously, and that requires taking seriously that we are embodied creatures. God made us as these embodied creatures. We are not brains on a stick. And the reason why liturgies work, the reason why rituals work, is because they get to our heart through our bodies. So I want to think this morning a little bit about why it's why little things matter and why we should sweat the small stuff. This is really about, again, there's always going to be a twofold aspect to this. One is recognizing the power of little things in secular liturgies. But then that always comes with a backhanded encouragement that don't underestimate the little things in Christian practices, right? Now, unfortunately, once again, I'm influenced on this by a French philosopher, which is always a bad way to start a Friday morning. But this is actually, I gave you two quotations just so that you can prove to your consistories when you get home that you were really working for the week. I was going to say I'm Dutch, but that's not right. my name's Smith. But. Okay. I'm Dutch in spirit. Pierre Bourdieu was actually an anthropologist. So he studied kind of global cultures and other peoples. And the burden of his work was to try to understand and appreciate the significance of practices in forming communal identity. So what makes this tribe a tribe, if he's studying in Micronesia, is not so much the things that they articulate as the things that they don't articulate, the things that they take for granted in the practices that they are a part of. That's what their identity is forged. And he has this insight about the significance of what I'm going to call micro-practices. Micro-practices. Listen to this first quote. This is quote one on your outline. This is from a work called The Logic of Practice. One could endlessly enumerate the values given body, made body, by the hidden persuasion of an implicit pedagogy which can instill a whole cosmology. Okay, so let's stop there. Whew! Here's all I want you to take away from that. What he's saying is, we know what pedagogy is. Right, we've been talking about that. We've said that actually rituals, secular liturgies, and Christian liturgies are meant to be pedagogies of desire. They actually train and educate our loves by aiming them towards some end, some vision of the good life. Now, notice he talks about implicit pedagogies. Implicit pedagogies. The reason why secular liturgies are often so powerful is precisely because they do not announce, I'm training your loves now. Right? They don't sort of walk in and say, hey, we're educating you to make you a certain kind of person. No, they're covert. They operate implicitly. These implicit pedagogies, however, can instill a whole cosmology. Think a word that maybe is a little bit more familiar for us. When he says cosmology, think worldview. A whole vision and orientation and understanding of who we are, what we're about, what this is for, what we're made for, what's wrong with the world. A whole cosmology, a whole worldview is instilled in us in these implicit pedagogies. But then notice what he pays attention to. Through injunctions as insignificant as sit up straight or don't hold your knife in your left hand, they inscribe the most fundamental principles of the arbitrary content of a culture in seemingly innocuous details of bearing or physical and verbal manners, so putting them beyond the reach of consciousness and explicit statement. Okay, if you hang with that, that's not as brutal as it seems, but because what he's saying is these little injunctions, sit up straight, don't hold your knife in your left hand. Is that a rule, by the way? Is that a rule for us? Because I'm really gauche, if that's the case. They inscribe these little things, these little expectations, these little rituals, inscribe a bigger vision. They come loaded with a bigger vision. They get situated in a whole sort of civic culture about who we are. We are not that kind of people. They send signals about our identity. They happen in the seemingly innocuous details. Every time Bourdieu says seemingly is always very important, because he says, you might think these are innocuous. You might think these are insignificant. But in fact, there's something big going on. You know, he talks about, for example, physical bearing. This is something... Oftentimes, I think one way you can feel this in our culture is to feel the difference between gender dynamics. So without anybody ever telling me or didactically instructing me, as a white man, I have learned to inhabit space and comport myself bodily in ways that are, I think, the world revolves around me. Do you know what I mean? Like you sort of learn a stride, a strut, a kind of bearing, a physical bearing that I've just absorbed with a kind of socialization. Not because anybody ever said, "Hey, you get to do this." Contrast that with oftentimes women are implicitly instructed to have a kind of deferential bearing in space. And nobody has explicitly stated that. It all happens implicitly. Does that make sense? So what Bourdieu is interested in is these seemingly innocuous details that actually have big implications, that get inscribed in a whole vision of a social order. In fact, he calls these pedagogies cunning. They are cunning. Look at the second quote. "The cunning of pedagogic reason lies precisely in the fact that it manages to extort what is essential while seeming to demand the insignificant." That's all the takeaway we need there. They seem to be just asking you to do little things, but in fact, in doing that, they manage over time and as a cumulative effect to actually extort the essential, to extort something bigger. These pedagogies that might seem insignificant are actually very significant. And they are training us to inhabit the world in certain ways. I was struck by an example of this when I was reading the memoir of General Stanley McChrystal called My Share of This Task. I still am not quite sure how I ended up reading that. But anyway, it was actually very interesting for leadership insights. McChrystal was at West Point. Eager young recruits, eager young students, training for the officers' corps, and a general from the Vietnam era, you know, a major decorated general, came to West Point to give a lecture. And McChrystal was so excited because he wanted to hear sort of from one of the greats, grand discussions about military strategy and leadership and so on. But he was so frustrated because this general comes to West Point and he spends the first 25 minutes of his talk discussing with the students about the collar clips that they wear on their uniform. Dude, we have like the, you know, one of the great generals in the history of military, although not so great, it was Vietnam, but the great strategists coming to talk as a leader, and he comes and he talks to us about our clothes. Why are we talking about our clothes? Why are we talking about these stupid little collar clips? And this is what he recalls. "Gentlemen," the general said, "soon you will begin to wear the class shirt. You'll wear it every day of the academic year, and per uniform regulation, you will secure your collar stays that have been issued to you. It may seem insignificant to you now, but you're learning here attention to detail. And for the next few minutes, the combat seasoned colonel compared neglecting to wear collar stays with forgetting ammunition for our soldiers in combat. Focusing on even the small things, he reasoned, develops a leader who never neglects the critical ones. In other words, here was, you're in training at West Point, and part of your training are these things that might seem insignificant. But in fact, what happens is these all of these seemingly insignificant things get snowballed into a whole comportment and way of life, so that what you are learning by learning to wear your collar stays correctly is actually how to be a soldier. This is part of the micro training that has macro implications in forging communal identity, in forging solidarity, in forging camaraderie, in forging the ability to submit to authority. All of those become key practices in now being the people who are that brigade. I think it's a really interesting insight for us to now consider, how do liturgies do the same thing? How are there sort of micro practices that liturgies run us through that might seem insignificant, but actually are instilling a whole cosmology? Now, once again, we can do this backwards, and you can start thinking about the micro implications or the micro practices of secular liturgies. Let me try out one this morning. This comes loaded with a liturgy. Now, you know how I told you my kids mock me? So a couple of years ago, they mocked me because in every conversation I was part of, I would always ask the person, have you read Walter Isaacson's biography of Steve Jobs? Because I was like the Ancient Mariner. I was like buttonholing everyone. Have you read the biography of Steve Jobs? Have you read the biography of Steve Jobs? It is a really, really, I think, especially for people who have leadership responsibilities, it is a harrowing tale, but very instructive for just that reason. One of the things that is mentioned about Jobs is that he was a master of desire. He's a master of desire. Now, okay, this is a machine. It's a machine. Every machine that is going to do work for us has to have some kind of machine-human interface, right? There's got to be a keyboard, there's got to be buttons, there's got to be some kind of interaction between the machine and us in order for it to become an extension of us, to do things for us. What you still probably don't realize, if you come from like my generation and above, right, this still feels like Star Trek. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is crazy. And one of the things that changed, that Jobs changed, that I still feel like we haven't appreciated, is he changed the way we interface with machines. Because it went from the and by the way, every machine-human interface is actually bodily. Do you mean? There's some kind of material interaction going on. But nothing has ever been as intimate as touch. Right? And to transform the machine-human interface in this way, so that your iPhone is the kind of thing that you sort of caress, you know, you cradle. The worst thing in the world is to drop your iPhone. But there is a degree of intimacy in the machine-human interface here that is, I think, unprecedented. Now, what do we do with this? How might this function as a seemingly innocuous thing, but nonetheless might instill in me a whole cosmology? Well, like all great insights, I learned this from a beer commercial. There was a Michelob Ultra commercial. Terrible beer. Terrible beer. But there was a Michelob Ultra commercial. I love being with Presbyterians, so you can talk about beer. For some reason, Lance Armstrong was in this commercial. That's not happening quite as much anymore. So now it's a beer commercial. So it comes loaded with all the stereotypes of our culture. And the way the beer commercial goes is a bunch of guys are done work in the office. They come out of their office building. The car is waiting at the curb for them, or one of the guys' cars there. They're going to go get in the car. It's kind of a lame, you know, sort of boring car. And they don't want to drive in that car. So what do? They swipe, and all of a sudden there's a BMW there waiting for them. This is the car that they want. Cut scene. The guys are on the beach. As I said, it's a beer commercial. They see some ladies in the distance. As I said, it's a beer commercial. They're interested in these ladies, but they're far off. And so what do? Zoom in. The ladies are immediately available to them. And because it's a beer commercial, are also interested in them. Because they're drinking Michelob Ultra. Magic. They go to a club. There's a band playing on the stage. It's not really music that they're into. So once again, whoosh, swipe. What's there is available to them. Do you see what's going on here? What they did is they took the micro practice of the phone and sort of in this enchanted way translated into this is a way that you can inhabit your whole life. And what is the way that you inhabit that life? Well, what this is microcosmically teaching us is that anything that I want should be available to me here on my terms when I want it. And basically, I should never, ever, ever, ever be bored. It's like Nirvana's anthem finally came true. Here we are, entertain us. And if you're boring me, I'm back here. And what happens is there is a kind of liturgy of egocentricity that is cultivated by the way I relate to this. And all the commercial did was sort of macro that picture. That's not a verb, but it turned that picture into imagine if your whole life could be like getting everything you want on your iPhone. Well, what that suggests to me is that there are modes of interaction with this machine, not least because of the intimacy of it, that might seem to be innocuous, but actually are subtly over time, microcosmically and liturgically training me that the world should be available to me on my terms to tap, touch, zoom, swipe, caress. I'm not giving you my iPhone, by the way, but it's something. Now, here's the other flip side of it. What do we do with this? And I also think we could spend time talking about the liturgies of social media. Now, and I say this as somebody who is an unabashed Twitter user. I had Facebook for about 2 months, several years ago, and that was a disaster. And I sort of deleted my account. So I say this as somebody who's not on Facebook, but as somebody who is on Twitter. How would we analyze the liturgies of social media? What could they do? By the way, this is always a question of how we relate to things. But systems like social media are also primed in certain directions. I think one of the great dangers, and I say this as a parent of teenagers, I think one of the nefarious effects of social media is to cultivate and amplify a degree of self-consciousness that is debilitating. Now, Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, has already, in both Sources of the Self and A Secular Age, analyzed that one of the features of modernity is what he calls mutual display. That is, one of the features of the mass mediaized culture that we inhabit is that we all increasingly have a sense that we are being watched. And because we have, which is what makes us self-conscious, and because we have this increasing sense of being watched, we also feel this increasing pressure to display, to put on a show, to be something that other people want to see. Now, in some ways, that is could just be a feature of being in a social context. But what happens when this is ramped up into social media is that actually there are never any spaces from which you escape it. There are no places. For example, I think, look, being a 15-year-old in high school was always a horrible experience of self-consciousness. But you got to come home. And you escaped the mean girls. Now, you never escape. Because at home is Facebook. At home is Twitter. At home is Vine. At home, and so what happens is you are always on display. And the self-consciousness that that breeds has this kind of paralyzing effect on us. Now, we could spend a lot more time on that. I would say this is precisely why I think one of the gifts of Christian worship should be a radical focus on God that takes our eyes off ourselves. And we, in an age of unceasing display and debilitating self-consciousness, that itself will be a kind of deliverance. That will feel like freedom. You know what? Sometimes I think the best thing about 20 minutes of daily chapel at Calvin College every day is that everybody has to turn off their phone. 20 minutes. Just give me 20 minutes where we're not sort of on. Now, I don't say that as a Luddite. You know, hello, Macintosh. You know, I'm saying the question is, how do we relate to these things? And again, being attentive to these dynamics might be the beginning of sort of defanging their effects in that regard. But I think it's worth thinking about the intentional processes we need to think about. So I think that this is both opportunity and challenge. It's a challenge to recognize these debilitating practices, micro-practices, but it is also an opportunity to recognize that if these little things matter in secular liturgies, maybe little things matter in Christian liturgies. Maybe we should stop underestimating the significance of the little things that we do as the people of God that over time snowball, they build up, they kind of accumulate an effect on us, and they come back. Do you know, you've probably, even if you haven't read Proust, you've probably heard of Proust's famous Madeleine in Remembrance of Things Past, where he dips his Madeleine is a little French cookie, and he dips his Madeleine in his tea when he's an older man, and the olfactory activation of that experience brings back a whole life of memories because it's that visceral tangible. You've probably had that, or have you ever heard a song and you remember roller skating when you were 14 and you remember that song playing? There's something, that's the aesthetic and effective sort of working. What would it mean to think about tangible, visceral, effective Christian rituals that over time are actually implanting the gospel in us and are activated in that way? Someone shared a story yesterday, beautiful story. I thought this is a great example of a congregation in Kansas. Where are you, sister? Are you here? Yeah, thank you. That had this practice of, make sure I get this right, for every person's baptismal birthday, they would light a candle on the font. Am I getting that right? And so every baptismal birthday was celebrated because this is who you are. You are a son and daughter of the King. And imagine, it's a little thing. It's a little thing. But it's actually a very effective little catalyst for everyone to remember their baptism. And I was thinking about what would it look like for a life to have been lived with that little micro practice. And I would think that every time you saw a candle lit, there would be echoes of who you are and whose you are. When our we have two boys at Calvin College now, and there was the 1 year at least, there was this sort of farewell ritual where you come and you're dropping your kids off, and a service of worship together, and then fonts would be at the front. And parents were invited to come up with the child that they were leaving that day and just mix their hands together in the baptismal font to remember the promises of baptism. I have tingles right now too. And I bawled my eyes out. But now that's a sort of one-time affective ritual, but it actually works because in that ritual you actually activate all the past liturgical formation that you've been immersed in as a result. Little things matter. Little things make a difference. So I want us to think about, I'm going to give you, I want to show you a clip from a film. Okay, I'm tired of listening to me. I'm guessing you're tired of listening to me. This is a film, and I want us to think about what I would call the embodied shape of Christian apprenticeship. Think of worship. Inviting people into worship is a way of inviting them to a kind of embodied apprenticeship. And I want to show you this clip from a great film called The Visitor. Has anybody seen The Visitor? Not as, oh, interesting. It's a great film. The dynamics about I'm all excited. The film is actually really about issues of immigration and justice and so on and so forth. I'm going to introduce just one clip in the middle. The story revolves around a gentleman who's an economics professor from Connecticut named Walter. Walter is sort of the last WASP. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's just this button-down Connecticut economics professor who, the most important thing you need to know is that he has been recently widowed. And he is profoundly alone. He lives in Connecticut, but he keeps an apartment in New York for academic conferences and things like that. He has not been back to that apartment that he shared with his wife for a long time. But there's a conference happening in New York, so he comes from Connecticut back to his apartment, walks into the apartment only to find people living there. People have been, through some machinations, somebody fooled them into thinking that they could sublet the apartment. They are both illegal immigrants. Walter walks in and says, what's going on? But Walter makes a very important decision. He says, you can stay. You can stay. The dynamic of the film is really about hospitality. And you would think that Walter is welcoming them. In fact, we'll see if you watch the whole movie that they welcome Walter. But the clip I want to show you in the middle here, I just want you to watch it as a metaphor for how Christian worship in a very tangible, visceral way might invite people into who they are called to be. Let's start it with that, if that works.
Recording was stopped at this point while a multimedia presentation was delivered. We will now rejoin the event in progress.
It's a beautiful picture. And what intrigues me is the way in which Walter is invited to become himself, but in a very tangible, visceral way. Yeah, I love it. The first time you see him in the park, when he's first hearing these drums, he's like glum and just profoundly slouched kind of thing. But did you notice, even the first time, there's a little bit of this. Just a little, very hard to resist. Just a little, and then the next time we see him, he chooses to sit there because he's sort of grooving with it. And in a way, the metaphor I want us to take away from this is that intentional, embodied, tactile Christian worship is our evangelism. That is our evangelism. It is like inviting people to belong to this community of practice and to try on these rhythms, because it's in these rhythms that you find out what you were made for. It's in these rhythms that you are going to become who you were made to be. It's in these rhythms that you will find yourself. And Tarek has just such a beautiful picture of hospitality here. Do you notice? Because notice what hospitality is in this. Hospitality is not knocking down the walls and just letting people do whatever they want and making sure that above all they are not weirded out. Hospitality is actually, do you notice what Tarek's doing? He is inviting him into a normed practice. It's It's not fours, it's threes. I don't know if that even makes sense musically, but and here's how you play. It's not, oh, you want to play the drum? Just bang away on it. Just do whatever you want. No. Here's how you play this drum. But sit down. I'll show you. I'm going to play alongside you. And every time you see Walter, it's like he's a Canadian. He's always saying, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You know, he's messing it up. He feels like he's doing it wrong. And what does Tarek say? Don't worry. Keep trying. Keep going. There is a hospitality that invites him into the particularity of the practice at the same time that he is embodying apprenticeship alongside him to say, this is how you put on a new identity. This is actually how you remember who you were made to be. Well, for the sake of time, I'm going to stop there and just leave us with this suggestion that in some ways, our evangelism, and sometimes we are evangelizing the converted, right? Our evangelism is to proclaim the story in practice and to invite people to begin to inhabit those practices in such a way that they put on Christ. They are putting on the virtues that are the training for them to then be sent as image bearers of Christ into the world. And in so doing, they find themselves. They find who they were made to be. Thanks very much.